Erev Tov, everyone. Welcome to Torah 1.0 here at SPL. This is the week of Parashat Tazria. Tazria is the 27th portion of the Torah. And it's a relatively short portion. Some years, depending on the number of weeks in that given year for the Hebrew calendar, it's actually combined with what will be next week's portion. But Tazria covers Leviticus chapter 12 and chapter 13. And we will probably spend a good chunk of it just in the opening verse, or really the second verse of chapter 12. I do want to go ahead and warn you this evening, it probably will be a little bit longer class. So just want to give you a heads up. So if you have to leave at the normal time, that's okay, or if you need to go get some water. And I don't mean it's going to be like 3 hours, but I mean it's going to be at least 10 to 15 minutes longer. Just because the concept that I really wanted to bring out that's in Tazria just takes that long to develop. This is the short version of what's in there. All right. So I just think it's fair that I go ahead and give you that heads up, but I think it'll be worth your while. As we embark upon that, because we'll be looking at how this portion ties directly to the virgin birth of Messiah, the idea of redemption through the birth of a son, as well as the connection between the birth of a son, Messiah, and leprosy. All right, so all of that kind of weaves together in this week's portion, and so it takes a while to unpack. So let's get started with the blessing before the study of Torah.
Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'sivanu le'asoch b'divrei Torah.
Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who sanctified us with his commandments, has commanded us to be immersed into the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. Tazria, we're going to look at the opening words of Leviticus chapter 12, verse 2, for our Hebrew lesson, because the first verse is basically one of those, and the Lord said to Moses, or the Lord spoke to Moses kind of things, and then it begins really in verse 2 of chapter 12 with these words, Isha ki Tazria, Isha ki Tazria. Isha is just the Hebrew word for woman. Man is Ish, woman is Isha. So this is just the Hebrew word right here, these three letters, that's woman in Hebrew, Isha. Isha ki Tazria. Ki can be translated a number of ways, when, for, because. Context just kind of dictates what you're going with. And then when we put that together with the verb over here, Tazria, which means to give birth, to conceive, to become pregnant, kind of all of those, then the context would seem to indicate that the key should probably be a when. So when a woman conceives, when a woman becomes pregnant. Different ways you might want to say that, but that's what it's getting at. And as we're going to unpack, Tazria is really not the most common verb, not the most common way you would express a woman being with child. And you're good first century Hebraic thinkers. And so when you come across something in the scriptures that's using an unusual verb, it is asking you to take a pause and say, according to your Hebraic toolbox, what might be the gezera shava? What might be the verbal tally? What might be the connection that is intending me to go from here to this place over here? And as we're going to see, Tazria is that. So, for instance, when Eve conceives, the Torah does not use this verb for Eve conceiving a child. But when we discover what the root word is for Tazria, then something very significant, especially from a messianic, Messiah-centered, shadows of Messiah perspective, really comes leaping off the page at us. All right? So that's why Tazria is significant. So let's say it together. Ready? Isha ki Tazria. Again, that means the woman becomes pregnant. Now, if we're going to think about a little bit of the spiritual technology side, again, as I've said to you before, when you come to a portion in the Torah, when you first open up your Bible to that portion of the Torah, it's good to, again, imagine like light or hearing energy vibrations kind of radiating off the page, and then say, what is the connection? What is the vibration? What is the frequency? What is the energy that God is particularly given to me to tune in to me in this portion? And when we look at that phrase, Isha ki Tazria, we can be mindful that bringing life into this world is one of the most ultimate forms, one of the most ultimate deeds of sharing. And much of what you're going to find in spiritual development, personal, national, global, cosmic, what goes on in spiritual development is the idea of using the technology God has given to us, especially through our Messiah, Yeshua, of overcoming our ego and our desire to receive in exchange for the desire to share. And when we want to receive, it's only to receive so that we may then give. All right. This is a fundamental component of all of Torah and all of Scripture and really all of God consciousness. And bringing life into this world is one of the most ultimate forms of sharing. You may remember that when we read the Torah, as we discussed last week, we are given the ability to actualize, to internalize, to realize, and dare I say, incarnate the very energy and thing that is being studied. So you're not just reading a story on a page, but you are reading something that can actually come alive in your life. And one energy that is contained within the portion Tazria is that we have an opportunity to do extraordinary acts of sharing, particularly with someone maybe with whom we've had a problem in the past, or perhaps even a stranger. That's a particularly unique feature to this week's portion, that if you're open to it spiritually, you're aware of it consciously, and you seek it with desire, then you have now the opportunity to deal with someone that maybe you've had problems with or struggles with in the past, or even a stranger, but the way you're going to overcome those difficulties is through some act of extraordinary sharing. Sharing allows us to change in a way that is not possible through other means, because sharing is one of the most powerful ways, along with Zedekah, which loosely translated is charity, but it's a little bit different concept. But sharing and zedekah, giving, they have a unique ability to break down the ego and the self. Sharing can bring so much light and a deep connection to our Messiah, but sometimes, after we've connected in a very deep way, there is a terrible feeling of letdown, that idea of you've had a mountaintop experience and then you go back to work on Monday and it's kind of a letdown from maybe what you've recently experienced. And so it's equally important to be focused spiritually after we've experienced a real connection to Messiah, a real connection to the light of our Creator, so that the letdown will not be as severe, or that it won't disappoint us or surprise us or discourage us, knowing that it's going to be coming, therefore when it comes, removes a little bit of the sting. Nothing in the Torah happens by accident. All right? Stories and accounts are not just randomly placed next to one another. They inform one another. Even if they seem completely disconnected, they are not placed next to one another by accident. They inform one another. They build upon one another. They complete the story. And so in tonight's Torah portion of Tazria in Leviticus chapters 12 and 13, it describes first giving birth and the ideas of clean and unclean, impure and impure related to that. And we do have to unpack that a little bit, but we'll continue to unpack that through Leviticus. But then it goes straight from giving birth and things related to giving birth to leprosy. So what is the Torah's logic behind connecting birth and leprosy? So we're going to hopefully get around to making that connection. Okay? So that's where Tazria, the word, takes us. So when we look at Tazria, that's kind of what immediately is laid out before us. Those kind of concepts. So let's dig into the text and see what we can uncover. So the opening two verses, and we'll be primarily focusing on that second verse where it begins with Isha ki Tazria, when a woman gives birth, when a woman conceives, when a woman becomes pregnant. But it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak. Now notice that. Spoke, saying, speak. We won't unpack that, but you need to unpack that on your own. Why you got to say speak, spoke, saying like that many times and like five words? You told me you're going to speak like three of those five words. All right? But they're different words, different tenses, different ways of saying it. Spoke, saying, speak. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, that's kind of redundant, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, when a woman gives birth and bears a male child. So, as I said at the beginning, this week's portion is called Tazria, after that first main word of the portion there in verse 2, meaning she conceived, she became pregnant, she was with child, she gave birth, all of those would work. Here in these opening verses, the Torah is speaking about the conception of a son. On its simplest level, that is on the level known as Peshat, these opening verses speak of any woman conceiving and bearing any male child. But from a messianic reading, from that viewpoint that we've been taking in Torah 1.0 now for 27 weeks, where we are consciously looking for shadows of our Messiah through specific tools, we indeed come across something different. So let's think about what we're really reading here. First, we are reading about a woman giving birth to a son. And there is no mention of the father. Who, by the way, before we get off on a tangent of clean and unclean, the father becomes just as impure and unclean in this process as the mother. But that's a side thing. But we have a woman giving birth to a son without mentioning of his father. So a woman giving birth to a son with no mention to a father should give us as followers of Yeshua a hint that this kind of sounds familiar. We kind of know of stories about a woman giving birth to a son where the earthly father really doesn't play a larger role as in other birth accounts. The Hebrew of Leviticus 12, verse 2, literally says, when a woman conceives and gives birth and bears a male. Then we have the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 7:14, behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son. Micah 5:3, when she who is in labor has borne a child,
Revelation 12, verse 5, Messiah says, and she gave birth to a son, a male child. Revelation 12, 5 literally quotes Leviticus 12, 2. But lest you think I might be starting to reach a little too far and are dreaming fanciful things, through the use of remez and verbal tallies, the Gospel of Luke also ties Leviticus 12 to the birth of our Messiah. Leviticus chapter 12, verse 3, the next verse, says, on the eighth day. Now you should be remembering some things from last week about when you encounter that eighth day phrase. On the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. And then three verses later, verse 6, it speaks of the sacrifice the new mother is to bring when the days of her purification are completed. And wait till you find out how many days that is. The Gospel of Luke tells us that after a certain woman gives birth to a certain male son, notice the redundancy of that, male son. That's the Torah for you. A male son. It then says, when the days for the purification, according to the Torah of Moses, were completed, Miriam brought the prescribed sacrifices. All right, in other words, Luke directly quotes Leviticus 12 when it speaks of Mary, Miriam, giving birth to Yeshua. It then says she followed the customs, what was outlined in the Torah, in the law, which is outlined for you right here in Leviticus 12. All right? And then it goes on also in the birth narrative of Yeshua to mention that on the eighth day he was circumcised. And so you have the same words, the same description, the same scenario, and even a direct reference when Luke says, as according to the Torah, the law of Moses. For one, on a pashat, Luke is wanting to show us that Yeshua's parents did everything in accordance with the Torah of Moses. But on a deeper level, on the remez level, Luke is connecting Leviticus 12 and the birth of Yeshua. Therefore, by the rules of remez and the Hebraic understanding of Scripture, Luke is letting us know that Leviticus 12 contains secrets, but I mean that in the more theological term, not the mysterious, you don't know something that I know meaning. But that Leviticus 12 has secrets about the Messiah. We'll also see in a little bit how that word Tazria even brings home the point even more about that this is about Messiah, that it's unmistakably messianic. Now, we're going to keep going and we'll get to, well, what is it saying then about Messiah? Okay, you sort of got me interested. You sort of got me thinking maybe you're on to something. This is about Messiah, as a hint of Messiah, as a shadow of Messiah. What is it? All right, we're going to get there. All right. But now what may seem to be an excursus, but hang in there. Again, Leviticus 12, verse 2. She shall be unclean for 7 days. A woman who gives birth to a son is unclean for 7 days. The Torah speaks frequently about states of clean and unclean. Ritual purity is a basic Torah concept that, especially to Western ears, because when we hear clean and unclean, we hear pejorative type things. Like, if someone's unclean, we mean that negatively. We mean something's wrong, something's immoral, something's not right when we say something's unclean. You know, that's a clean movie, that's an unclean movie. That's clean behavior, that's unclean language. Like, we use it in those terms. The Torah doesn't mean anything like that when it uses clean and unclean. But it's so hard to divorce our understanding of the words clean and unclean. We're going to start to try to deprogram that a little bit tonight. According to the Torah, it is possible a person to be ritually clean, which is tahor, which is on your handout, or ritually unclean, tameh. But
what does this really mean? Being ritually clean, I'm going to first address it on the pashat, and then I'm going to address it on the deeper level for you. And of course, ultimately, it's the deeper level that I want you to take home with you. But on the pashat, being ritually clean means that a person is what we would say is fit to enter into the sanctuary, the holy place of God, to participate in the tabernacle worship services, to eat of the sacrifices. Whereas a ritually unclean person cannot. However, a ritually unclean person can become clean through purification. And that is outlined in the Torah. All right? So, Yeshua at times was unclean. That's just a fact. And I don't care what your theology is. Yeshua was unclean a lot of his time in our Gospels. So hopefully that's enough to let you realize it's not a pejorative term. It's not a moral judgment. It has nothing to do with sin or our sinfulness. It has nothing to do with any of that. But Yeshua often was unclean. Whenever he touched a leper, he became unclean. Whenever he was around a dead person or touched a dead person or brought a dead person back to life, he became unclean. Whenever he went and hung out with Gentiles, he became unclean. And he had to go through what the Torah prescribed to become clean again. Now, when we get to the deeper meaning of clean and unclean, you're going to go, oh, that makes sense. All right? I'm going to unpack the Hebrew roots of those words. But on the basic level, clean means you can participate in the holy stuff. Unclean means until you are purified, you cannot. After purification, the person is qualified. It's clean. They can enter into the tabernacle, eventually the temple, participate in the services. In the Western worldview, again, it's common to equate ritual uncleanness with moral deficiency or spiritual unworthiness, but they have nothing to do with that. In the Torah, there's nothing morally deficient or spiritually unworthy about someone who's ritually unclean. In other words, ritual uncleanness is a normal human condition that every human being experiences and is actually part of God's design for the human system. It's a good thing, and it participates in rhythm. That's when, eventually, when Leviticus will get into family purity laws and so forth. There's a reason for impurity during a cycle and so forth, because of the effect that it has on the relationship and the family, that it's actually a positive one. And so it's a normal part of human experience, just like going to work. Many of you, when you go to work, you may come home dirty. Or at least sweaty. Or maybe you enjoy coming home and feeling like you need to take a shower. That's when you like to take a shower. Or at least before you head out to work the next day, you want to take a shower because of what the day has put on you through your labor. Well, when you come home and you're dirty from work, it doesn't mean you're a bad person, right? It doesn't mean you did something wrong at work. It's just my job, you know, running a bulldozer, digging up holes in the ground, kind of means I get dirty. It's not right or wrong, good or bad, any of that. It just is. That's what clean and unclean is. It's just part of the human experience on the Peshat level. Wait till we get to the deeper level. The causes of uncleanness are manifold, from types of relations you have, childbirth, menstruation, contact with a corpse, a leper, contact with a carcass of an unclean animal, bodily discharges, all of those can potentially be the sources of uncleanness. In our day, when concerns about clean and unclean may seem mostly irrelevant, because there's no temple for us, there's still a lesson for us. On a Peshat level, we learn at least this lesson. We learn that God's people paid very close attention to their spiritual and ritual state. Ritual state, ritual cleanness really meant they were paying attention to their spirit, their spirituality, their standing in their relationship with God, where they were in that relationship. And this tells us that they took that very seriously and paid very close attention to it. And if they were planning on entering the house of God or partaking of the sacrifices, they were scrupulous to avoid ritual uncleanness. They avoided what would render them unclean. How seriously do we take preparing for worship? How seriously do we take encountering God? Think about even our routines before we may go to a worship service. How many of them are filled with, like, you know, there's a classic video that I showed a few times in my previous congregation where it shows a family at their home 30 minutes before church service. And they are yelling at each other. They're calling each other names. The kids are fighting. The parents are just like, you know, almost ready to throw in the towel. Then the drive to church, it's just chaos. And then they open the door and they're like, all of a sudden it has them glowing halos over them. And they're like, hi, bless you. The Lord bless you today. You know, as if they had been preparing for coming to church all morning and were just this super holy family, right? They took seriously the idea of being prepared to enter into the presence of God. They took seriously preparing themselves inside and out for anything related to holiness, anything that was holy. And this, of course, means beyond just cleaning up or wearing nicer clothes. But do we avoid contact with things that would make us unclean? That is, do we keep our eyes from seeing things that they shouldn't? Do we keep our hands from things that they shouldn't touch? The worship of God is holy, and the worship of God is serious business. If not for anything, it clearly teaches that in Leviticus. But let's take pure and impure, clean and unclean, to the next level. And just don't worry about totally understanding all of what I'm about to say. Just soak it in. Soak it in. Write it down if you need to. Review it. Think about it. All right? But I'm right. All right, so let's take it a notch and go deeper. Pure. Pure means clean, stainless. And thus, when something is pure, it means that the Creator's light can easily go through it, as opposed to something that is impure. All right? Tameh in Hebrew are also the same letters and the same root as tamum. Atum, I mean. And so, light will only go through it partially, or not at all, if it's impure. So, pure and impure, think about it as a glass with liquid in it. Pure is if I shine a flashlight, it's going to go through and shine to the other side. Impure would be if I shine a light into it, maybe on the other side you might see a little circle of something hovering next to the glass itself, or you may not be able to tell I'm even shining a light through it. So when we are pure, it means we are in a state, a spiritual state, not a physical state, a spiritual state where the light of the Creator, which anytime I say light of Creator, I need you to also program in your mind Messiah. It's the same thing. Light of the Creator can shine through us. Whenever the Creator's light, whenever our Messiah can be seen through us and in us, we are in a state of spiritual purity. Whenever that's dimmed, where it sort of can see it, got to focus real hard, maybe turn on some other lights around it in a very literal way, or you can't see it at all, if you are not having Messiah shine through you, if people cannot see Messiah in you, if the light of the Creator is not flowing through you, then you are spiritually impure. So ultimately, purity and impurity are not religious or moral issues, but it's a matter of awareness and God consciousness. According to our thoughts and actions, the Creator plants our life story. And we have the free will to decide which way we want to walk through it. What kind of thought we would like to have, pure or impure, that the light of the Creator can shine through it, or that it's going to be dim. Every path we choose will have its story. But eventually we are going to reach the same destination. But according to the Torah, it's the path that you choose that will make all the difference. All right. Now, let's just keep on these opening verses. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, say, when a woman gives birth and bears a male son." It literally says male son, not male child. "Whenever you encounter an unusual word or an unusual usage of a word in the Torah, as I said earlier, it means to pay attention." So here's an example of methodology for you. So what we're about to learn is not just true for this case, but this case helps you understand how to do this throughout Scripture. "The uncleanness that results from childbirth can be traced back to the Garden of Eden. When Eve fell, or more properly, when Eve miscalculated, missed the mark, and collapsed..." You're going to need to parse those verbs, because it's not that she just sinned. What does that really mean, especially in the Garden of Eden? It means she miscalculated, she missed her mark, and she collapsed. "When that happened, the Lord spoke regarding womankind, saying in Genesis 3, verse 16, 'I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children.' The ritual impurity that accompanies childbirth is a shadow that is cast from that faithful day in Eden. But on the same day, the Lord also spoke regarding the offspring of the woman." Literally, not offspring, but literally seed, S-E-E-D. "And then throughout Genesis, from that point on, the word seed becomes a buzzword, and eventually a title for the Messiah. So God spoke to the serpent, and he said in Genesis 3, verse 15, 'I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed.'" It is interesting that in Genesis chapter 4, woman is spoken of as having seed. We might ordinarily assume that the seed is attributed to the man and not the woman. But in biblical Hebrew, this is not always the case, especially because in Leviticus 12, it says, "If a woman conceives." Not only is there no mention of the man involved in the conception, a shadow of Yeshua's birth, but the very word the Torah uses implies the seed of a woman. Seed is that, again, that word that hints at Messiah. The word Tazria, the name of our portion, that word from our Hebrew lesson that means to give birth, to be with child, to become pregnant, so forth, is based on the root word zera, which is that Hebrew word seed. So literally, Tazria doesn't, I mean, you would never translate it this way, but it, I guess the FIV would, the Foster International Version. When a woman seeds. When a woman seeds, or when a woman gives seed, it's literally what Tazria means, because it's coming from Zara, which means seed. You see, Tazria is not the normal word for conception. The normal Hebrew word for conception is Hara, H-A-R-A-H, which is on your sheet, Hara. In Genesis 4 passage, where it says Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived, it does not use Tazria there. It uses Hara. So why does the Torah say Tazria when it could have, and in reality it should have said, Hara? By using the word Tazria,
the verbal form of zerah, the Torah is using the verbal tally to allude us back to the Genesis 3 promise of the seed of the woman, the one who crushes the head of the adversary. And so the very term tazria for Hebraic ears says, oh, seed. Seed in the Torah is a capital S, not a little s. Because it's speaking of one, the seed from Eve. And then as it gets more focused, the seed of from Noah, the seed from Abraham, the seed from Isaac, the seed from Jacob, the seed from Judah, and so forth and so on. And so the use of that word says, well, this has to be tied to that promise of the seed, because it's used in that word. And it's a rare word. You shouldn't be using that. So the only reason you'd be using that is to make me think of the promise of the seed in Genesis. There's no other reason to use this verbal form in Leviticus 12. Messiah is the seed of Abraham. In the patriarchal narratives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Genesis, we saw that the promises of the zarah, the seed, is a prophecy of Messiah. Shaul, the Apostle Paul, taught that the seed of Abraham is, in fact, a title for the Messiah. Therefore, when Leviticus 12 so cryptically begins with, if a woman seeds a male son, it is impossible not to read a messianic interpretation into the text. The seed of the woman is the Messiah. It is also worth noting that Judaism has always understood the birth of a son as a symbol for messianic redemption. As Messiah would be born, a son born of a woman, born under the law. For instance, in the morning prayer, traditional morning prayer, Hannah's song from Samuel is sung. I remember when I was first learning to pray, to pray what is known as the Siddur, the traditional prayers of the Jewish people. This is what a completely Orthodox rabbi, who not only was not a believer in Yeshua, but was not even close to being a believer in Yeshua, this is what he actually said. And I quote, "The reason we sing Hannah's song every morning," which if you read Hannah's song in Samuel, it sounds like what we call the Magnificat in the Gospel of Luke. Mary basically paraphrases Hannah's song when she sings about what she's going to give birth to. But he says, "The reason we sing Hannah's song every morning is because it tells us the story of the miraculous birth of a son who would save his people, and therefore we are reminded every morning of the promise of Messiah." End quote. Note that Miriam, as I said, sings a song that clearly echoes Hannah's song regarding the birth of her son who would save his people. I think we're ready to move up a verse. "Then she shall remain in the blood of purification for 33 days. She shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed." So the Torah goes on to say that the mother who gives birth remains in purification for 33 days. Blood of purification is the term the passage uses to designate the period of time that it takes a new mother to return to that state of purity, because part of the birthing process is part of the redemption process, which also therefore entangles her with part of the fall process. And that's where her spiritual impurity, not her physical, moral, or judgmental impurity comes from. It's not an ooh-icky impurity. It's a spiritual impurity, because the birth of a child in reality, especially the birth of a male son, is spiritual warfare. And it takes 33 days for the light to shine through her again because of what she's gone through. This speaks of the child of Miriam, Mary as well, for his blood is the blood of purification. The New Testament calls it that. Through his purifying blood, we become cleansed. We're brought into that heavenly tabernacle, the one above, not made with human hands. And we find our purification in the blood of the son of Miriam as we await the completion of days when he will return to Jerusalem. Then the long exile will be over, the temple rebuilt, and we again will be pure and enter the sanctuary, like the woman, like the bride, if you will, returning to the temple after bearing a son. And, what was the approximate age of Yeshua when he died? 33. Interesting. So that's a little bit for now about conceiving a male son, seeding a male son, and a little bit of what's connected with it. Then all of a sudden, the Torah kicks into talking about leprosy. Naturally, right? Naturally. That's an obvious connection, right? What's going on there? So let's talk a little bit about leprosy, and then we'll see if we can put it together. Leviticus chapter 13, verse 3. It is an infection of leprosy. When the priest has looked at him, he shall pronounce him unclean. So the Torah goes on to introduce us to now the laws related to leprosy. If a man or woman exhibited certain symptoms, the person was to show himself or herself to the priest. Upon examining the person's symptoms, the priest determined whether or not that subject had leprosy or not. And only the priest could do this. In addition, the priests were responsible for examining the household mold to determine whether personal belongings or even an entire house was leprous. So leprosy is not a physical disease. It is not just eczema or skin issues. Leprosy is a spiritual condition that manifests itself physically. That's why not only people can have leprosy, but floors, walls, and entire houses can have leprosy. Your house cannot get the chicken pox. Your house cannot get the flu. Your house cannot have a sore throat. But your house can have leprosy. Your wall cannot get the sniffles. But your walls can get leprosy. So leprosy is not a physical disease. It's a spiritual malady. And probably next week we'll talk more about what is that spiritual malady. It's what's known as Lashon Hara, the evil tongue. That's the malady. But we'll get to that later. That doesn't help us tonight. But it's a spiritual malady. The English translation of leprosy is also problematic. It's coming from the Hebrew zarat. It's not the same disease that is called leprosy in modern medicine, which is also known as Hansen's disease. That's not biblical leprosy. Biblical leprosy, again, is a broad term used to describe not only skin condition, but what we would also call mold growth, for lack of a better description. Meaning, again, a spiritual condition that manifests itself through different physical realities. The Torah goes into great detail describing the various maladies, whether on the person or in the household, that could be classified as leprosy. By comparing these diverse maladies, it's obvious that biblical leprosy, zarat, is not one single disease or affliction. It encompasses several different yet similar diseases, but again, it's ultimately connected to Lashon Hara, evil speech, gossip, slander. Leviticus 13 is a manual for the priest who are attempting to diagnose zarat. It makes for difficult, boring reading. The Hebrew, even if you know Hebrew, is very obscure. And even the best translations in English are very unappetizing. It's just a very difficult part of the Bible, which makes it really all the more interesting. If you were a priest responsible for determining whether or not a person had leprosy, this is where you would have turned. This would have been your manual. The priest never wanted to declare someone leprous, because to do so meant to cut that person off, not only from the tabernacle and things that are holy and all that went on with that, but it cut them off from family, from vocation, from community, from society. If it was all possible to dismiss a skin affliction as a mere rash or swelling, the priest would want to do this. But when the person's symptoms matched what they knew to be true, the Torah compelled the priest to declare the person a leper and unclean. Leviticus 13, verse 11. It is a chronic leprosy on the skin of his body, and the priest shall pronounce him unclean. He is unclean. The Torah's concern with leprosy is a matter of ritual purity. Leprosy is unlike other maladies because it renders the victim ritually unclean. The priest making the diagnosis declared a person with leprosy as unclean. And so as long as he had this disease, his state of uncleanness could not be reversed. The leper was forced to withdraw from participation in the religious ceremonies as well as the community ones. The ritual uncleanness, again, was contagious. Just as Lashon Hara is probably the most contagious disease we have. That is, once one person starts gossiping and slandering, we all want to join in. We all quickly catch the disease. And then, by the way, we can deduce that Lashon Hara is the cause of leprosy from the Gospels alone. Yeshua tells us that. But we'll get to that next week, probably. Probably. As for the leper who has the infection, his clothes are to be torn. The hair of his head is to be uncovered. And that's because of what hair on a spiritual level represents. And he shall cover his mustache, his beard, his facial hair, and he shall cry, "Unclean, unclean." He will remain unclean all the days in which he has the infection. He will live alone. His dwelling will be outside the camp. That's Leviticus 13, verses 45 through 46. The only thing as contaminating as a leper is a human corpse. So we're going to begin to make that connection. The leper to the corpse. The Torah treats the leper as a man who has already died. According to the Torah, the leper is literally a dead man walking, or a dead woman walking. They are expelled from the community. They are required to mourn their own death. They are to rend their garments, which is the mourning process, cover their face, uncover hair, let it be unkempt. All of those are mourning rituals. The rites are spoken of elsewhere in the biblical text as the rituals for mourning the dead. And so they really have to mourn the death of their self, which when you know what the cause of it is, Lashon Hara, which is really your ego gone crazy, the only way you cure that is to die to self. And so they literally have to mourn the death of themselves, their real self, not their physical self. A skin affliction like biblical leprosy, again, is a living death. It's a living decay of the human body. This may be why the Torah singles out leprosy as the only disease that renders a person unclean. Unclean as if they had come into contact with a corpse. The spiritual reality is that we are all like the lepers. Though we are alive, we dwell in mortal bodies that are dying. And from the moment we are born, we have begun to die. As we grow older, our bodies deteriorate, Leprosy advances through the flesh, and on a spiritual level, our mortal bodies are afflicted with the leprous condition that we call sin. In the apostolic scriptures, the New Testament, the human body is called the flesh, because it's relating it not to Platonic philosophy and that idea of the flesh, but to leprosy, that which is corruptible, decaying, and dying. Just as leprosy corrupts and spreads through the skin, so too sin through our bodies, leading to death. And even though we are alive, we are like the walking dead. Shaul says that until Messiah cleanses us, Romans 7:5, we are at work in the members of our body to bear fruit for death. So how can we ever be brought close back? How can we ever get back into the community? How can we ever become alive again? How do we become pure and clean again? Well, now you're beginning to see the link of why the Torah put the birth of the Son, Messiah, and this idea of the walking dead together. Because Messiah is the solution to the problem. We were given the solution before we were given the problem. Leviticus 13, verse 46. He shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone, his dwelling place outside the camp. And there's your nice verbal tally to Hebrews and our Messiah. Where did our Messiah die? Outside the camp. Now, as we've been talking about, aside from leprosy, no human ailment renders a person ritually unclean, except death. Why is leprosy associated with uncleanness? Again, the symptoms described in the Torah involve decomposition, decay, putrefaction, corruption of the flesh. While studying the sacrifices, we've already noticed that the tabernacle, its worship services, shunned corruption and decay. It was to be heaven on earth, the place where there is no tears and there is no death, right? It was to be this pure place. In keeping with this tendency, the Torah commands that the flesh of the sacrifices must be burned up after 2 days. If the meat is allowed to turn rancid, the entire sacrifice is invalidated. The same impulse towards incorruptibility lies behind the laws of the grain offering. The grain offerings are all made without leaven, because leaven represents corruption, because the leavening process is actually the fermentation of the dough. For the same reasons, the sacrifices were salted, which is why you salt the bread on Shabbat. Salt is a preservative which slows down the decomposition process. God's sanctuary is about immortality and incorruptibility. In His presence, there is no death, there is no decay, there is no decomposition. Therefore, the disease that represents living decomposition is banned from His presence. Leprosy is an ongoing, visible progression towards physical corruption. It is the antithesis of immortality and incorruptibility. An important principle that I've already stated, or at least hinted at, is that in the Torah, leprosy is really an archetype for all human sickness and sin. Sickness results from the breakdown of the flesh. Sin is a breakdown of the spirit. Death follows. Leprosy graphically represents that progression. In God's eternal sanctuary, there is no sickness, there is no death, there is no decay. His sanctuary on earth was to be a reflection of that eternal reality. Therefore, lepers were banned from the sanctuary. The Torah linking the birth of a son and leprosy tells us that the seed, the Tazria, right, must be the solution to this leprosy, sickness, sin problem. And when we'll get to Isaiah 53 in a little bit, where it uses a specific language associated only with leprosy. In other words, Yeshua is the solution. Spiritually, he did not suffer the leprosy-like infection of sin. Physically, his flesh did not suffer corruption. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay, the Psalms say of him. Through his resurrection from the dead, his flesh passed from the mortal to the immortal, from the corruptible to the incorruptible. His body is still real human flesh, but it's regenerated as imperishable spiritual body. This helps explain why the healing of lepers occupied a central concern in the ministry of Yeshua. And on my website, there's an entire hour-long class on why Yeshua dedicated so much of his ministry to the lepers. Not only did he heal the lepers himself, but he gave his disciples the authority to heal leprosy as well. Leprosy, again, symbolizing the sin-laden human condition, destined for decay, corruptible. Each time Yeshua healed a leper, it betokened a reversal of the corrupted mortal state back to incorruptible and immortal. Every leper healed of their affliction was a testimony that the kingdom of heaven had indeed come close to men. But let's put it all together. If my voice will hang on. All right, so I'm going to go through this, just absorb it. So this evening, we have discussed two different concepts alluded to in the portion of Leviticus known as Tazria. That is, messianic redemption through the birth of a son and the spiritual root of disease. Although both have the theme of purity and impurity in common, there doesn't seem to be any other obvious link between them. So why did the Torah have a portion, a very short portion, where it combined the laws for birth of a son and the laws for leprosy? We're now going to shed the light between these two unseemingly related matters. And I think the link is found in a very enigmatic portion of the Talmud. In Tractate Sanhedrin, Folio 98a, the Talmud, someone comes and is looking for Messiah. And in the discussion, they say the Messiah is a leper sitting as an outcast at the city gates of Rome. Now, that's a loaded statement in the Talmud, because Rome in the Talmud always represents the church, Edom, Esau. Where do the Talmudic sages know their Messiah is? He's an outcast at the city gates of Rome. They're really hinting at something quite deep there. But then one of the sages asks, how can the Messiah be distinguished from all the other poor and sick lepers that are gathered outside of Rome? He is told that all the others, when changing their bandages, remove all of them at once and then replace them one by one. But the Messiah takes off one bandage at a time before changing the next one. Why does he do this? So that if God calls upon him to reveal himself to his people, he will do so without delay. The fact that the Messiah is depicted as a leper is very noteworthy, because the prophet Isaiah describes the future Redeemer. Most people think it means that he will be associated with being afflicted with sickness and disease. That's sort of true, but it's more specific than that. Isaiah 53, verses 3 through 5. He was despised and isolated from men. That's what lepers are. A man of pain and accustomed to illness. That's what lepers are, because when you are physically decaying, guess what? You're open to everything. You are open to every kind of sickness and every other kind of infection going on. As one from whom he was despised, isolated from men, accustomed to illness, that we would hide our faces. That's what you do with a leper. Despise, no regard for him. But in truth, it was our ills that he bore, our pains that he carried. But we had regarded him as diseased, stricken by God and afflicted. We're going to pay attention to that famous phrase. Diseased, stricken, smitten, and afflicted. He was pained because of our rebellious sins and oppressed through our iniquities. And the chastisement upon him was for our benefit, and through his wounds we were healed. This is more powerful when we remember that leprosy is equal on the symbolic level to sin. So the Messiah is taking upon himself our sickness, our leprosy. Because that vocabulary, stricken, smitten, afflicted, that's used exclusively of lepers. So I know people like to use it for other diseases and stuff. And I'm not going to say you can't or that you shouldn't, because I'm not going to do that. Oh, that wouldn't be right. But the context is it's specifically talking about leprosy. And then when we remember leprosy is specifically acquainted with sin, then we know we're talking about something else. Rabbi Yitzhak Ginsburg, one of the leading rabbis of Jerusalem alive today, explains that being stricken with a sickness is an opportunity for growth. Such an experience enables us to make a tikkun and learn empathy, compassion, mercy, and love. Throughout the ages, he says, the tzaddikim, the righteous and holy individuals, would use their afflictions to both identify with and empathize with the suffering of others. As well as, because they were righteous in suffering, they would elicit compassion for God for the plight of other people. I.e., it brings atonement. When the righteous suffer, it brings atonement from on high for the people. In Hebraic thought, the tzaddik, the righteous one, has the potential to transform sickness into redemption. Messiah, of course, is the quintessential tzaddik, the tzaddik ha'emet, the true tzaddik. And thus he is the one who's able to take the suffering and transform it into healing energy that will envelop the whole world. Leviticus 13, verse 2, describes leprosy in four ways. When a man shall have in the skin of his flesh a swelling, a scab, a bright spot, and it be in the skin of his flesh, the plague of Zarat. The Midrash connects these four descriptions with the four exiles. A swelling is Babylon, a scab is Persia, a bright spot is Greece, and the plague is Rome. These correspondences between the exiles of God's people and the leprosy and the Talmudic story depict the Messiah as a leper, suggest to us on the soul level that leprosy serves as a parable for that which will befall God's people. And even on a Peshat level, this correspondence can be sensed as the leper is exiled from the camp for 7 days and then returns only when he is healed, which would be the 8th day in one sense. So as we talked about at the very beginning, the birth of a son is connected to the Messiah and the Messiah's redemption because of its connection to the seed, the one coming from Eve who would crush the head of the adversary. Continuing in the same vein, we can explain that a woman giving birth on a remez represents God's people's mission to redeem the world. And so the 7 days of impurity following the birth symbolize and remind us of the long and harsh history of exile and persecution God's people have suffered serving in this mission. In other words, the 7 days of the woman's impurity
represent the complete time of existence for the world as we know it. Because seven represents a complete cycle of time. But the Torah portion this week, right after describing the 7 days of impurity, struggle, leprosy, battle with sin, exile, states that on the eighth day, the boy was to be circumcised. Circumcision is deeply connected to the covenant aspect of God, His covenant faithfulness. Circumcising the male child on the eighth day, therefore, signifies that the covenant between God and His people will ultimately be realized and finally consummated when God's people and the entire world are fully redeemed when Yeshua the Messiah comes. And so we can see that the birth of the Messiah and His ministry are intimately connected to leprosy and sin. So much so that the Jewish sages have as one of their titles for Messiah the, quote, leper Messiah. That's one of His titles, the leper Messiah. Now we know why Yeshua spent so much time with lepers. For on a deeper level, it was a fractal, a paradigm of who He was and what His mission was really all about. It was part of bringing about the eighth day, the Messianic era. Yeshua was the Tazria, the one who was conceived to bring healing, physical and spiritual, to the lepers, so that the leper could be declared healed, whole, clean, pure, and thus enter into the presence of God and His kingdom. That's the connection between the two. All right. I didn't go too far over, so good. We will continue to meet next week. We'll continue looking, I believe, at some more leprosy. All right, so let's close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai notein ha-Torah. Blessed are You, Lord God, who has given to us the Torah. Amen.